Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Well, hello there and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour.
Coming up in a few moments, making that leap from suffering to joy, the legacy of a blissful Dominican, and when Michelangelo paints an intense-looking St. John the Baptist. Well, thanks for joining me. I'd like to begin today by reading a passage from Pope Benedict XVI's encyclical by the title of God is Love, a passage which highlights love as both receiving and giving. It's read for us by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Love becomes concern and care for the other. No longer is it self-seeking, a sinking into the intoxication of happiness. Instead, it seeks the good of the beloved. It becomes renunciation, and it is ready and even willing for sacrifice.
These lines from Pope Benedict's first encyclical reminded me of a reflection by Dominican preacher and poet Father Paul Murray, focusing on our human quest for happiness, in which he explains how joy can be attained by what is apparently its very opposite, namely the experience of suffering. Father Paul.
But how, since it is so often destructive of human happiness, can suffering bring joy? In the Gospel, Jesus links these two words, these two realities together in an astonishing way. Happy or blessed are you, he says, when people hate you and when they exclude and insult you. Rejoice and leap for joy on that day. The first thing to note here is the central place given to happiness in Jesus' teaching. Of all the doctors of the Church, St. Thomas Aquinas was perhaps the most aware of this fact. Thomas notes, for example, that in the Sermon on the Mount and in the Beatitudes, Jesus draws our attention not only to the various precepts of the law, but also to the fact, the wondrous, saving fact, that our lives in this world and in the next are ordered towards happiness. The Beatitudes represent, in fact, nothing less than God's answer to our human search for happiness. And the Beatitudes are addressed, all of them, to people who have taken the risk of loving others or of loving God. For immediately we decide to love someone, not just to fall in love, but to stand in love, we at once become vulnerable in all kinds of ways, and not least to the pain of loss that we will experience if that person abandons us, for example, or if he or she dies. Blessed are they who mourn, for they shall be comforted. I have entitled this third road to joy, The Experience of Suffering, but it could perhaps more accurately be called the experience of loving. For real love, although it gives us a sense of happiness like nothing else in the world, also brings with it a new mysterious sorrow. We become aware, and with a vividness not perhaps experienced elsewhere, of something of our own and the other person's most pressing need and vulnerability. And here, as in all our close relationships, it is necessary, as Mother Teresa says, to love until it hurts.
Yes, there is not only hunger for bread, there is hunger for love. And he loved us so much that he died on the cross. And we too must love until it hurts.
Love demands two things. surrender, and self-sacrifice. This truth is something that the world, the materialistic world at any rate, never seems to understand. But it is something that every lover knows by instinct. Nobody understands lovers except themselves. Nobody understands their willingness to completely forget themselves, throwing to the winds their own selfish interests. And nobody understands their joy. In the context of the Christian life, it is only the man or the woman who has abandoned self and completely gone forth from self, as Meister Eckhart puts it, for whom nothing could be a cross or pain or suffering. It would all be a joy. The self-sacrifice involved in going out from oneself does not always come easy, even to the lover. There may be a certain impulse or instinct towards self-sacrifice, and that is wonderful. But instinct is not enough. The journey towards a great relationship presupposes a profound gift of grace, that first of all, but also a lot of hard work. One vivid illustration of this journey from self-centeredness to self-forgetfulness comes from the ancient Persian tradition. It is the story of a rather egotistical young man who falls in love with a beautiful woman. They get to know one another, and one day he decides to ask her to marry him. He goes to her door and knocks.
"Who is it?" a voice replies. "It's me," he says confidently. But the voice within says, "I'm sorry, I don't know you." The young man is deeply upset at these words and goes away puzzled. The next day he returns, knocks on the door again, still feeling pretty confident. "Who is it?" the voice answers. "It's me," he shouts this time, emphasizing the me. "I'm sorry, I don't know you." This reply completely bewilders the young man. He goes away and stays away for weeks. In fact, he goes alone out into a desert, where night and day he fasts and prays. Then he returns to the door of the woman he loves. He knocks on the door. The voice from within replies, "Who is it?" This time, pressing his face up very close to the door, he whispers quietly, "It's you." And the door opens.
What the young man discovered through his own experience of suffering is that the door of life, the door of joy, never opens if it is approached merely in a selfish spirit. Like every man, like every human being, he is naturally drawn to seek pleasure and to possess the thing that he desires. But what he discovered in the desert is that the hidden desire, the deepest desire in his heart, is not to seize joy for himself, but rather to give joy and to give pleasure to the one he loves. And so the journey he has made is, we can say, a journey from a place of selfishness, it's me, to a place of self-forgetfulness and communion, it's you.
Warm thanks there to preacher and poet Father Paul Murray, a Dominican who has some eminent predecessors in his order of preachers, among them Fra Angelico. Most of us are familiar with his artwork, but who exactly was he? And how did he come to be a preacher and painter? It was with the intention of finding out that I made my way up to the Aventine Hill one afternoon to speak to a fellow Dominican you may already be familiar with, as he's often been a guest on my programme. He resides at the Church of Santa Sabina, where St. Dominic and St. Thomas Aquinas once lived, and he's Father Robert Ombres, the Procurator General of the Order of Preachers. But before I'll allow Father Ombres to paint for us a personal picture of this fra, I'd like to tell you a little bit about Fra Giovanni of Fiesole, the Beato Angelico's name in religion. He was born around the year 1400 and given the name of Guido in the Tuscan village of Vicchio in Mugello, near Florence. When he turned 20, he entered the Dominican order in the new convent of strict observance in Fiesole, perched above Florence. It was here that he was ordained priest, and here that he painted the Great Annunciation and Coronation of Our Lady masterpieces. His artistic skills were immediately remarked by Cosimo de' Medici, who entrusted to him the convent of San Marco in Florence. But recognition of his talent went beyond the boundaries of Tuscany, leading him to Rome, where Pope Eugene IV asked him to paint a chapel in St. Peter's Basilica. Famously, in the Vatican, he also painted the chapel of Nicholas V. It's in Rome, in the Dominican convent of the Minerva, that he ended his days. And should you wish to, you can visit the church of Santa Maria Sopra Minerva, where you will find his tomb to the left of the high altar. Strikingly, a sculptured face of this friar is visible on the marble slab which covers the tomb. But it's not about Fra Angelico in death that I wish to speak to you about. So at this point, I'd like you to join Father Robert Ombres to find out more about this Dominican artist who so masterfully features angels in his paintings, including dancing angels. Stay tuned then as I ask him my first question. Shall we start then with 1982, when John Paul II signed the motu proprio for the liturgical cult of the Blessed Angelica? Was that a surprise to you as an order?
No, I think we'd in some sense wanted it for centuries, and that's precisely what it was. It was the recognition of a devotion, a cult, to him as a blessed, as a saint, for a long, long time. The timing could have been some years before, some years later, but that it happened, I don't think, caught us by surprise.
You're an order of preachers. Fra Angelico was an artist. Where's the connection there, and what was his special charism?
The connection is communication. One of the many mottos of the Dominican order, of which I'm a member, a friar, to give to others the fruit of our contemplation. And I think, therefore, painting, as in this case, lends itself first to being communicated, and then to being precisely the fruits of contemplation, because of all the elements of contemplation, vision is one of them, to see. And traditionally, heaven will, for us, mean the beatific vision. And therefore, for a Dominican artist, it wouldn't be a big jump to communicate through the skills he had. And it's generally accepted that Fra Angelico was a painter before he joined the order. Was already trained and already very able. The medium might have been the same, but the message changed.
So what was his message, do you think, in particular? He painted a lot of angels, didn't he? And he was known as the Beato Angelico.
This goes back a long way. I think he died in 1455. 100 years after that, another painter, but also a writer called Vasari, wrote the lives of the artists, the painters, in the same Florentine milieu which Fra Angelico belonged. And so collected lots of tradition, stories about Fra Angelico. And I suppose it was for the last 500 years due to Vasari that the name has stuck, but it didn't start with him. Angelic, different levels, I think. One, because of the purity, the holiness of his own life, which was recognized by many, and hence the tradition of his own holiness, sanctity. The subject matter, which often included angels, as you say, and many people's Christmas cards have angels, and there'll be Fra Angelico's angels, extraordinary beauty, purity, which they reflect. And angelic, because it was thought that it almost took an angel to paint the way he did, not just angels, but all the other saints. I think there are many reasons then why he was known as the angelic painter and then as the angelic friar.
You have an angelic doctor as well, St. Thomas. Is there anything that you think connects the two?
Yes. I would say St. Thomas Aquinas was called the angelic doctor, partly for the purity of his own life, extraordinary splendor of it, if you like, of his virtues, and because in the Summa Theologica, best-known work, he has the longest treatment of angels of any of his writings, And within Catholicism, there became one of the standard accounts of the angels. And as it happens, the link is St. Antoninus, Archbishop of Florence, who knew Frangelico, personally lived with him in Fiesole in San Marco. And all of them would have had a respect for St. Thomas as a theologian.
The Beato Angelico.
Also known as the blissful Dominican. Does that mean he found happiness in the monastery or in his painting? Is there anything special in it?
Again, it's two levels, I think. It's in his own life. People often commented on how he never seemed to be angry, seemed to be meek, mild, withdrawn. He belonged to the observant school of Dominicans, a movement which goes back to St. Catherine of Siena. And as it happens, he's buried just a few feet away here in Rome from St. Catherine of Siena. And St. Antoninus belonged to the same movement. It's called the Observant Friars. I think Vasari thinks of his art as blissful and joyful because so much of it is based on heaven and communicates the radiance and the joy which goes with heaven being beyond tears and sin, beyond the need of repentance and of guilt.
What do you think his legacy is to us today? I mean, at the time he was considered to be a modern painter. Now we see him as the latter part of the Renaissance and beyond. He obviously has an appeal because people flock to admire his masterpieces. Do you think they understand the spirituality?
Not completely, but then I'm not sure that the preacher expects to be understood completely, especially by non-Christians or non-Catholics. But something is always communicated of the truth being true for everyone. I would say that he was in a moment of transition in terms of art, of technique, of we usually call the Renaissance, the Middle Ages, Byzantine art. So he was innovative and traditional. I think people go for the sense of spaciousness he gives them, whether they're believers or not, the sense of transcendence, that beyond the visible and also importantly, within the visible, there's a depth which isn't exhausted by the five senses. And I think he manages to convey that even to people who wouldn't call themselves Christians or believers.
Is there a particular painting that means something to you? Maybe you mentioned that you'd visited the Dominican convent in Florence by San Marco. Is there something there?
I visited San Marco more than once, and here in the Vatican in Rome is a chapel painted for Pope Nicholas V by Fra Angelico, recently restored. It was the Pope's own chapel, where only the Pope and a few others celebrated Mass. But then, of course, I've seen exhibitions, I've seen books, I've seen postcards, because his work now is scattered at least a dozen museums around the world. There's one in Britain, in London, in the National Gallery. A detail of one of his paintings, if I had to choose one to keep, is that moment which I think you alluded to, where in heaven, in the transfigured world, angels and saints, in the light of God, almost are in a dance in a garden, because that shows us both the unity of creation at all its levels, angelic, human, plants, living things, and it's transfigured. It's what it was, but more than it could ever hope to be. And I think that communicates the joy and the desire for the things of God to me.
Do you want to add anything? What Fra Angelico means to you personally, or an episode that you'd like to connect to something, or someone?
I would mention another Florentine, Dante Alighieri. In the Paradiso, at one point, Dante refers to Beatrice, his beloved Beatrice, and he says that she is the one, I'll say it in Italian first, but it's fairly clear in the English translation, quella che m'imparadisa la mia mente, she who imparadises my mind. And that's more or less a verb coined by Dante, to imparadise his mind, m'imparadisa la mia mente. And I would say why Fra Angelico has come to mean so much to me is that he imparadises my mind. He manages to convey and make attractive and convincing the glory and the splendour beyond the suffering of Christ, the crucifixion of Christ, the suffering of the martyrs, the mess of the world in all its different forms. In a few words, mine, not his, I would say that in Fra Angelico, the disfigured becomes the transfigured, and I think he imparadises my mind.
And warm thanks there to Father Robert Ombres, Procurator General of the Order of Preachers. And now why not join another great artist, Michelangelo, who depicted the Last Judgment fresco on the walls of the Sistine Chapel. Our Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, is sharing with us some ideas as to the depiction of one of the figures there, St. John the Baptist. Looking at the fresco, he's to the left of Christ.
Looking as intense as he is described, in a sense.
A devilish face, in a way.
Well, no, it's severe more than devilish, no. But he's generally portrayed, dressed in unkempt clothes and looking like a wild man from the desert. He's trying to warn people, like, Messiah is coming. He's very near. So wake up, you people. This is the feeling you get from this figure. And it's lovely when you look at the eyes. I mean, he has a hooked nose. He's not a beautiful-looking man, if you want to put it that way. But there was a wonderful expression in his eyes, though. He's looking with an adoration at the figure of Christ the Judge in the middle. Because this was the content of his message. This was his role. And he's a very special man. He's celebrated on the 24th of June, which is his birthday day. On the 29th of August as well, which was the day of his martyrdom. So he's the only saint, along with the Virgin Mary and Jesus, whose birthday is celebrated as a feast, an official church feast. All the others are celebrated on the day of their martyrdom or their death. And this is because he was sanctified already before his birth, because his actual birth was miraculous in a sense, and he prepared humanity for the coming of Christ.
So he's an in-between man. He's between the Old Testament and the New Testament.
Yes, he's the last prophet from the Old Testament and the first one of the New. So he is a link, almost like he clasps the two. He brings the two books together. More than even binding them, it's almost like he's putting some wonderful gold clip on the two of them to hold them together strongly. This is the feeling I always get.
That's a beautiful image.
He's a very, very important key figure in the linking of the two books. I mean, when I think of him in terms of the key figure, I'm jumping over also to St. Peter with his keys at the same thing. Because you always find some types of images that tend to float around certain figures. And he's one of these people.
Well, the way they're placed.
They're the two, let's say, the standing straight up and the two strongest, more muscular figures in the Last Judgment fresco. Because the Christ figure, yes, it is a muscular one, but it's more refined. The figures of John the Baptist and Peter are stronger and more rugged, let's say. A little bit like Hercules, the statue of Hercules. So when people asked him who he was, St. John, he answered, "The voice of one crying in the wilderness." And you can actually feel the intensity of this in this face that you see here. And look, his arms are down by his sides. So it's almost like he understands that what he had to do was done. And of course, remember that Christ chose him to be baptized. So he was baptizing before the arrival of Christ. And then the real baptism, he had this wonderful gift that Christ chose him to be baptized in the River Jordan.
Reader, apart from this depiction of both St. Peter and St. John the Baptist in the Last Judgment fresco, these two figures appear elsewhere in the Sistine Chapel in a different manner.
You have the fresco on the lower part of the Sistine, where you have Peter receiving the keys from Christ. You also have the first fresco just to the right of the altar, where you see St. John the Baptist baptizing Christ. And again, in that fresco below, he's shown in his more classical garb, holding the long cross, standing with one foot on a rock and one foot in the water, and he's baptizing Christ. And he's wearing the robes that we normally associate him with. So again, it's a repetition here. He's repeated in the Sistine Chapel. So this also underlines the importance of his role. He sometimes holds a lamb, which has a cruciform nimbus, no? The lamb is one of his iconographical attributes, because he was the one who said, "Behold the Lamb of God." He's here to one side of Christ, and he's the person who brought the message to the people and brought the direct link to the Messiah who came. And on the other side, you have St. Peter, who received that message and brought it down into the Sistine Chapel for us. And this is why this link with the Pope is so terribly important, because you're coming through the prophets, through the revelation, which is an action. Obviously, here you have the judgment, but it's the judgment as the result of the revelation. And then on the right-hand side, you have Peter, who created, let's say, the earthly church. And then below that, you have the altar of the Pope.
Michelangelo was a very knowledgeable person about the church.
Well, yeah, not only knowledgeable, but he was also very religious. This is something people tend to forget, because I think Michelangelo had this extraordinary capacity to immerse himself in what he was trying to paint. And trying to give the totality of his spiritual self to creating something that would give and inspire a message in the people who are observing for years to come.
And many thanks there to Breda Innes, a professor of fine arts who's currently working at the American University of Rome. That brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.